The headlines: United Nations warns that Somalia's rapidly worsening drought has left more than 2 million people facing severe food and water shortages. Britain says it's banned Palestinian resistance movement Hamas as a terrorist group. Hamas says the move shows London's submission to Israeli blackmail and dictations. And in Hungary, the number of daily COVID-19 cases climbs to the highest since the start of the pandemic, as the country registers 135 new deaths. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story: the United Nations raises the alarm on drought in Somalia, saying over 2 million people face severe food and water shortages in the African country. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says the drought has already forced nearly 1,000 Somalis to flee their homes in search of food and water. The body cautions about a fourth consecutive season of poor rainfall in the country, describing climate change as one of the main drivers. Meanwhile, Somali officials are warning that more people could face starvation as they lose their livestock and slide deeper into poverty. This comes as the Horn of Africa has experienced more than 30 climate-related hazards since 1990, including 12 droughts and 19 floods. Well, Saudi Arabia is ramping up its aggression against neighboring Yemen. The kingdom carries out fresh airstrikes against the war-torn country, leaving several casualties. Multiple positions in at least 7 provinces, including Sana'a, Sa'ada, Hodeida, and Ma'rib, were targeted overnight. The air raids left 1 civilian dead and 2 others injured in Hodeida. 3 civilians are also rather wounded in Sa'ada. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has condemned the attacks, warning that Riyadh will face the consequences. The Yemeni army has also vowed not to let the attacks go unanswered. Riyadh and its allies launched a war against Yemen in March 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have been killed and millions more displaced as a result. Iran's foreign ministry warns against attempts to use the International Atomic Energy Agency as a tool to exert pressure on other countries. The ministry said such moves do more harm than good to the perpetrators, as they hurt the agency's legitimacy as a technical and specialized body. It urged that the IAEA's decisions should not raise suspicions of political motivations. This follows France's Thursday statement urging the IAEA's Board of Governors to send a strong message to Tehran. The statement cites a recent IAEA report complaining that Tehran has not fully cooperated with its inspectors. The agency's Board of Governors will meet next week ahead of a new round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. Thousands of people, including farmers, gathered in Iran's central city of Isfahan to protest actions resulting in a major river drying up there. The protest took place on the banks and barren riverbed of the Zayan Darud, which has lost almost all of its water in recent years. The demonstrators are critical of dam construction and the development of water-intensive industries. They also blame the redistribution of Zayan Darud's water to other cities for its arid state. In response, the Iranian first vice president ordered energy and agriculture ministers to take immediate measures to tackle the issue. Mohammad Mokhber acknowledged the difficult conditions, adding that the government is seriously seeking a solution. The number of deaths and infections from the novel coronavirus is shrinking in Iran as the government is speeding up the vaccination drive. Health officials have reported some 5,800 new cases. Over the past day, 100 COVID-related deaths have been recorded in the same period. Meanwhile, more than 101,000 doses of COVID vaccines have been injected as the process is accelerating. Containing the pandemic, increasing the imports of vaccines, and speeding up the vaccination campaign have been among top priorities of the new government in Iran. European countries are tightening curbs to control their rising COVID infections, with some states reimposing or considering full lockdowns to battle the surge. Austria becomes the first Western country, or European country, that is, to reimpose a national lockdown. It says a measure will take effect on Monday. The country also plans to make COVID vaccinations mandatory as of February 1st next year. Germany is considering similar measures as well. The government says the COVID situation there is so grave that a full lockdown, even for the vaccinated, cannot be ruled out. It says that Germany is facing a national emergency. Other European countries are also tightening the restrictions as cases surge across the continent. On Friday, Hungary registered its highest daily case tally since the start of the pandemic. Russia logged a new record in its daily deaths. Tensions remain high between France and the UK over fishing rights in the English Channel. Now Paris says it will not back down from its demand of having the same number of licenses. France's Europe minister says the British Channel island of Jersey must grant all outstanding requests for post-Brexit licenses to French fishermen. Clement Bonneau said Paris would continue negotiations as well as pressure. The two sides have been at odds over the number of licenses the UK allocated to French fishing boats after its departure from the European Union. Paris says many requests have been denied, while London says it's respecting the Brexit deal. France has threatened to prevent British boats from offloading their catches at its ports. China condemns the opening of a de facto Taiwanese embassy in Lithuania amid escalating tensions between Beijing and Taipei. The Chinese Foreign Ministry called the move an extremely egregious act that defies the One China rule. It reiterated Beijing's position on Taiwan as an inalienable part of China's territory, saying any move to seek independence is doomed to fail. China also demanded that Lithuania immediately correct its wrong decision. On Thursday, Taipei said it has formally opened an office in Lithuania using the name Taiwan. In July, Lithuania revealed an agreement to let Taiwan open what it assumed as a new diplomatic outpost in Europe. China then responded by withdrawing its ambassador to Vilnius. The Indian government decides to repeal its agricultural reform laws a year after the controversial legislation sparked mass protests by farmers pushing for its annulment.
Today I have come to tell you, the whole country, that we have decided to withdraw all three agricultural laws. In the parliament session starting later this month, we will complete the constitutional process to repeal these three agricultural laws. I appeal to all the farmers who are part of the protest to now return to your home, to your loved ones, to your farms and family. Let's make a fresh start and move forward.
The Indian government passed those laws last September, allowing farmers to directly sell their products to big buyers. New Delhi said that that would boost rural incomes. But soon after the move, farmers began protests in different parts, with thousands camping out near the capital. Some held their positions until now, saying the laws allow conglomerates to take over the farming industry. The protests turned violent on some occasions, leaving a number of people dead and injured. In this segment of the program, Britain says it has banned Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in its entirety following the suit of the United States and the European Union. The UK Interior Minister claimed that Hamas has, quote, significant terrorist capability, including access to extensive and sophisticated weaponry. Priti Patel, however, did not make any reference to Israel's deadly attacks against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Tel Aviv welcomed the move, which Hamas slammed as biased toward the Israeli regime. Senior Hamas official Sami Abu Zohri said the designation is in fact London's submission to Israeli blackmail and dictations. He said the group has the right to resist against Israeli occupation by all available means, including armed resistance. London banned the military wing of Hamas known as the Izzeddin Al-Qassam Brigades back in 2001. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Robert Carter, who's with us from the British capital, London. Also joining us from London, Ontario, we have international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Robert in the British capital. Talk to us more about this decision by the UK, which was announced by the UK Interior Minister.
Sure. Well, obviously it is a move which may have surprised some simply because it was announced quite abruptly this afternoon. However, if you look at the direction in which the current government has been taking British foreign policy in regards to the Israel-Palestine conflict, then you can see a trend of becoming more radical, more extreme in its support of Israel over the demands and the needs of the Palestinian side. Now, Home Secretary Priti Patel herself is a very well-known and established supporter of Israel. She actually compromised her political career in 2017 after being embroiled in a row over illegal and rule-breaking trips to Israel, where she engaged in private conversations where it turned out that actually political matters with Israeli politicians was also being discussed at these meetings, which shouldn't have been allowed to take place. She decided to carry on with that track, and now she's back in government. She's continued on that trend of being pro-Israel in her policy making. But also, I think worth noting is a report that was revealed by Declassified UK, an independent journalism platform based here in the UK, revealed a study last May that revealed that up to a third of the current government, including the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, has received money over the years, either coming out of Israel itself or from several pro-Israel groups and organizations which are active both here in the UK or over there in Israel. So this idea that the UK would take what is essentially a very undemocratic position in regards to the elected organization Hamas in the Gaza Strip isn't that much of a surprise if you look at the track record of the politicians which are currently leading this country. They've made clear they're pro-Israel, they're going to support Israel, and this is just one example of where they can come and do a favor for the regime in Tel Aviv, which they've made very clear they're happy to do over the last couple of years.
Edward Corrigan, what are your thoughts on this designation? A senior Hamas official has said that this is in fact London's submission to Israeli blackmail and dictations. Do you agree with that?
In part, I agree with it, but it's also true that Britain has had a long-standing agenda with regard, and it's very anti-Palestinian, with regard to the Balfour Declaration, regard to, you know, the British mandate, and of course where the British, to a large extent, facilitated, you know, Zionist immigration into to Palestine. So the British have their own agenda on here as well. But it clearly is anti-democratic, because Hamas is the most popular political party within the Palestinian movement. It's more popular right now than Fatah is. And you have, you know, it's a way of delegitimizing it. But, you know, we have to remember that Menachem Begin and Israel Shamir were both designated as terrorists by the British government when they were resisting the British occupation in Palestine back in the mandate period. And you also have to recognize that, in fact, Israel was the organization that helped create Hamas in order to divide the Palestinians into a religious stream and a secular stream, so they could use the Hamas to undermine and to, you know, work against the Fatah and the PLO. So it is complex, but you can't. There's, you know, Hezbollah. Every party in Lebanon is sort of tied to a religious community. Every party in Israel almost is tied to some sort of religious component. And you know, you have even like the Christian Democrats and parties in Europe that also have, you know, at least historically, you know, a strong element of you know, religion behind their policy and their legitimacy. So it is clearly anti-democratic. And of course, you know, the Hamas is right that they have the right to resist against, you know, the Israeli occupation, the Israeli blockade, and of course the repeated Israeli attacks against the Palestinian people, which of course, you know, the British are deaf to. But it really points to the weakness in sort of the pro-Palestinian, the pro-Arab, pro-Muslim community in England, that they are, you know, not, don't have any political impact. And of course, the government of England and Prime Minister Johnson can totally ignore them and, you know, delegitimize them as well, even though they do represent a very large portion of the electorate in Great Britain. And of course, you've seen this the fight within the Labour Party, where you had, you know, people like the Mayor of London, Jeremy Corbyn, you know, who were expressing pro-Palestinian views, but they were attacked by the media, attacked by pro-Zionist organizations. And, you know, it's clear that the Zionists have, you know, almost a lock on British politics, even though there is independent Jewish voices and a lot of, you know, principled religious Jewish figures and academics that speak out against Israel's aggression against the Palestinians.
And Mr. Corrigan, your final thoughts on the issue. Priti Patel nonchalantly referred to significant terrorist capability of Hamas, in her words, including access to extensive and sophisticated weaponry, altogether forgetting about Israel's deadly attacks against Palestinians on the Gaza Strip with their sophisticated American-provided arsenal and weaponry.
Well, it's probably a ratio of 100 for Israel and 1 or 2 to Hamas and the Palestinians. So there's a huge discrepancy. To follow up on the previous interview, you know, the Israelis have also attacked Palestinian civil human rights organizations in Israel and in the occupied territories. And so they're trying to extend this designation of terrorists against, you know, Al-Haq and other Palestinian groups. And now that seems to be the plan also going forward in Great Britain. And of course, the United States will be making similar sort of, claims to try to delegitimize Palestinians. So the Palestinians, you know, when Israel is confiscating their land or, you know, attacking them, they can't do anything. And they do something, and they're designated as a terrorist. So it's an entirely, you know, hypocritical position for the British. And of course, you know, does fly in the face of the facts, plus the democracy, and, you know, but it reflects really the weakness of the, you know, the Palestinian movement and their friends in England, even though they've had huge demonstrations and a lot of powerful people in England and Great Britain have supported the Palestinians. I think it part is a part of desperation on the part of the government, and that they know that there is, you know, a lot of broad-based support for the Palestinians, and that's what's concerning them, and they're trying to cut that off.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Robert Carter, our correspondent, joining us from London, and thanks to international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, joining us from Ontario. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Stick around.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. In a New York City borough where residents have long struggled to afford their homes, thousands of people are now threatened with eviction as state pandemic aid dwindles. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Mir Zaveri, Matthew Haag, and Sophia Cerda Campero. The piece is titled How the Pandemic Worsened the Housing Crisis in the Bronx. Stay with us for more of the New York Times article. Livia Fernandez used to commute every day from her one-bedroom apartment in the Bronx in New York City to an Ecuadorian restaurant in Queens, where she worked as a cook and earned $700 a week. But when the pandemic hit New York City last year, the restaurant shut down and she lost her job. Ms. Fernandez got COVID-19 in March of 2020, and ever since she has felt weak and unable to work. Her two young daughters were also infected. For 20 months, Livia Fernandez has not paid her $1,400 rent. She owes more than $28,000. Her landlord has yet to demand payment, instead hoping that Ms. Fernandez would qualify for a state pandemic relief program. But with the rent relief program now nearly out of money, Ms. Fernandez knows her housing situation is precarious. "Where will I go with two daughters?" Ms. Fernandez says. "I can't live in the streets." The pandemic has left millions of people across the country jobless and on the brink of losing their homes. But few places better illustrate the escalating housing crisis than the Bronx neighborhood of New York City, where working-class residents have long struggled to afford the city's rising cost of living. Before the pandemic, more than one-third of households in the Bronx spent at least half of their income on rent. More than 26,000 renters in the borough have been sued by their landlord since the pandemic began, the highest concentration of eviction cases in New York State, and more than in many large American cities, including Philadelphia, St. Louis, Cincinnati, according to the Eviction Laboratory at Princeton University. A state moratorium on evictions, one of the strongest in the nation, has helped keep the number of cases from being even higher. They are far below pre-pandemic levels. While many lawsuits do not lead to actual evictions, the mere filing of a case can land a renter on a so-called tenant blacklist, making it much more difficult to find and qualify for another apartment. Still, many residents, like Livia Fernandez, remain out of work and unable to pay their rent. The 12.4% unemployment rate in the Bronx neighborhood in September was almost triple the national figure. More than $248 million in pandemic rent relief has been distributed in the borough of Bronx, according to the most recent data, more than in the entire states of Indiana, Arizona, and Connecticut combined. The state has been so overwhelmed with requests for aid that it has stopped accepting new applications and says that more than 70,000 pending applications could be left in limbo without more federal funds. Interviews with landlords and tenants paint a very grim portrait of a borough in distress, where the housing crisis is straining economic recovery. Some of those who did not receive or qualify for rent relief because they did not submit an application or did not meet the criteria may face eviction once the moratorium expires this January. Others will struggle for years to climb out of debt. Without rental income, property owners could let buildings slip into disrepair. "I'm very concerned about the long-term impact of such a momentous event," said Matthew Murphy, the executive director of the New York University Furman Center. Ever since she moved to New York City from Guayaquil in Ecuador 3 years ago, Livia Fernandez has worked as a cook. "Since she lost her job, she has struggled to find work. She got COVID-19 again this March and has been unable to stand for long periods of time. I can't find a full-time job because I feel physically weak," she says. She cannot afford food and sometimes gets help from a nearby church pantry. she's especially concerned for her daughters, Clara and Marta. I can go hungry, she says, but they can't. I do nails, I clean apartments, I do anything. She applied for the rent relief program when the landlord of her Mott Haven building pushed her, but she said she had not received any notice that her application was being considered. I break down and start crying, she says, but then I control myself because who will take care of my daughters if I'm not around? Her landlord, Inocencio Gonzalez, could not be reached for comment. Without a job, Livia Fernandez is anxious about the future. Thank God my landlord hasn't been pushing or bothering with the rent money, but months keep passing by and my pressure has gone up a lot, she says. Mercedes Escoto, a 63-year-old, has not paid rent on her two-bedroom apartment in the High Bridge neighborhood of New York City since April of 2020. As of October, the sum of her unpaid bills, according to a letter she got from her landlord, was more than $43,000. In May of this year, the landlord filed court papers seeking her eviction. But like many renters facing eviction during the pandemic, her troubles had begun long before. 5 years ago, her landlord abruptly raised the monthly rent from around $1,400 to $2,000, she said. The rent would have claimed almost half of her income. Miss Scotto earns around $59,000 a year as a social worker and also takes care of her mother, who lives with her. I told them from the get-go I could not pay all of that, she says. Unable to afford the increase, she fell behind on rent. She borrowed money from a city emergency assistance program and took roughly $11,000 out of her retirement account for back rent, money she is still paying back. The pandemic worsened Ms. Scotto's financial woes. Her mother got COVID-19 in March of 2020 and needs a walker, oxygen, and pain pills. Ms. Scotto had to take weeks off work without pay. She struggled with anxiety and depression. I used to cry every day, she says. It was all too much for me. She also said she had a leaky bathroom ceiling and non-functional oven, emblematic of issues that are particularly prevalent in rent-stabilized buildings like hers. Unlike the city's other four boroughs, the Bronx has many more rent-stabilized units than unregulated apartments. She says that even if she could afford to pay back the rent, she is reluctant to do so until the repairs are made, especially as the moratorium on evictions has kept her case from moving forward. Mercedes Scotto has also applied for rent relief from the state. The landlord, a limited liability company associated with Isaac Casera, who has received national attention for pushing to gentrify affordable housing, filed papers last year seeking to deregulate the building so it can charge higher rents. In an email statement, Todd Rothenberg, a lawyer representing the landlord, said Ms. Scotto has not paid a single penny in 21 months. While the landlord has to pay me his property taxes, his mortgage, the heating, the hot water bill, etc., without any income whatsoever from Ms. Scotto. He noted that the landlord had agreed to charge Ms. Scotto a lower rent, around $1,500 a month, in October of 2020. It was not clear why she was still receiving bills reflecting a higher amount.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We are looking at the theme of dealing with temporal strife through living a Quranic life. We live in a society today, especially brothers and sisters, where from before our birth all the way up until our death, we are surrounded by enjoyment, pleasure, fun, entertainment. Do you and I actually recognize impacts of modern entertainment on our personal lives? Do we even think about this ever? That why did Allah tell us all of this was haram? Why did Allah say music, for example, of a certain type is haram? Why are certain things prohibited in Islam and certain things are allowed? Is it only that Allah wants to make Muslims to be boring people? That we don't have fun in life, that we just focus on the akhirat? Obviously not. But just as I said that we look to what we eat and we are careful of what we consume, we have to ask ourselves, are we careful of what we consume within our heart? And I would say this before we move on in this discussion tonight, that each and every one of us, if we're listening to the haram, if we're engaged in the haram, especially music is what I want to look at tonight because of this verse of Surah Luqman, chapter 31, verse 6, is that we have to ask ourselves sincerely the question of what impact that music is having on our soul. Nobody can answer that for you. This is something which each and every one of us, if we're listening to the haram music, that we have to ask ourselves, is this impacting me? Am I being told by my parents, for example, or my siblings, my brothers, my sister, or my community, that you know what? There's a change in your attitude. There's a change in your character. We have to look at all of these aspects, brothers and sisters, because as we will see, that music is not as innocent as the system that we live in makes it seem to be. When Allah says, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَشْتَرِي لَحْوَ الْحَدِيثِ لِيُذِلَّ عَنْ سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ وَيَتَّخِذَهَا هُزُوًا, when the Imams of Ahlul Bayt were asked, what is lahu al-hadith? Because this term, lahu al-hadith, as we know, lahu, we talked about this last night from chapter 57, Surah Al-Hadid, where Allah talked about the life of this world, hayat al-dunya, being la'ib wa lahu, and zinat and tafakhur and takathur. So one of those stages was the stage of lahu. So when the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, alayhum as-salam, were asked, what is lahu al-hadith? Literally, they said in the tafsir of this verse, and this is a hadith found in Mustadrak al-Wasail, in volume 13, the sixth Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, he gave the tafsir of lahu al-hadith in this verse as being al-ghina. Al-ghina being music. Now, I'll have to also unpack what music is, and I'll do that a bit later. But the sixth Imam says that what Allah has referred to in this verse is music, that is what has been prohibited for the believer. So right off the bat, if we were to look at this hadith and say that I will accept if the Prophet or Imams tell me that this is about music, that I would stop listening to music, well, this hadith right then and there in black and white, the sixth Imam was asked, what is lahu al-hadith, this vain talk, hadith being talk, words, discourse. What is lahu al-hadith, this vain talk, this worthless talk that has no purpose in life? It's music. And you know, those who listen, or even if you don't listen, but if you just go online and read the lyrics of the top music that the kids are listening today, you would see how vain the talk is. It's mostly about negativity. It's mostly profanity. It's mostly about alcohol, about drugs, about sexual relationships. There's very little, if any, in the top 40 industry of music at least, that is a positive message. Because there are forms, and we'll mention this, that are permissible in Islam. But now, maybe as a young man or young woman or an older person, you may say to me, well, Sheikh, you know what? I'm listening to the music with my headphones on. I'm in my bedroom. I'm out for a walk. I'm out playing sports. I'm on the bus going to school. I'm in my car driving to work. I'm not bothering anybody. What problem is there if I have my headphones in and I'm listening to some music? It's not hurting anyone, right? I'm not bugging anybody. There's no problem, right? And what we have to realize, even if we take it outside of the realm of Islam, we look at it just from a scientific perspective, let's say, is there is still a problem with the entire composition. Again, I will look at maybe very briefly near the end of what is halal in terms of music, but a majority of what is out there today, like maybe 95% of the music that the children are listening to, that's on the radio, that's on Spotify, that people are listening to on YouTube, this is mostly to do with haram. And if you look at any musical piece, you'll have two components. You'll have the music, the actual beat, and you'll have the lyrics. You look at the lyrics, as I said, if you just do an analysis of the top 40 music of any given time, look at what's online, and they'll tell you the artist and the song, and then you go and find the lyrics, and you read about the, you read the lyrics of what the youth of today are listening to, and you will find that 75 to 80 to 90% are about three or four things. One is about relationships between men and women, illicit, haram relationships. It'll be about drugs. It'll be about alcohol. Some of it will be very violent in nature. And most of it is full of profanities, of swear words, which as Muslims we know is problematic to use and also to listen to. So at one level is the lyrics. This is a problem, brothers and sisters. And don't say, oh, you know, I'm impervious. They're talking about drugs. I don't do drugs. They're talking about alcohol. I don't drink. They're talking about, you know, relationships with the opposite gender. I keep away from that, but I just like the music. These lyrics have an impact on our soul. And if that was not the fact, you know, much of the music that has a lot of vulgarity, a lot of negative content, they wouldn't have parental guidance labels on them that, you know, over 16 or over 18 can't, you know, buy that. Because they realize that when we're young especially, that this music can make an impression on our mind because we're much more impressionable at those young ages. So the lyrics we have to be very, very aware of. But what about the music itself, the actual tone, the content of what is being played? Scholars of the sciences, not Muslim scholars, but scholars in terms of sociology, of psychology, they've actually done a lot of research on the effect of music on the human mind and the dopamine levels, these levels of the brain's reaction to when it hears things. And they've actually come up with studies and research, even some research that was done in McGill University in Montreal in Canada, which went to show how the effect of music on the human mind is similar to that of taking drugs. So some of the same levels of ecstasy, of joy, of euphoria that people feel when they smoke marijuana or where they inject a drug, some of the research points to the fact that listening to music triggers those same hormones within the brain. It does something to the mind. And look online, there is much research done even about why they play certain music in the stores. Why is it, let's say, at a certain time of the year, a certain music is playing in the store? And they've shown how, through research, how they are able to control the spending habits of people when they come shopping, depending on the music that the store is playing. They've shown, they've done tests that when they play a certain music in a certain store, people stay longer. They graze around, they walk through every aisle, and they spend more money. So don't think that the music industry is all innocent and it's just there to provide us with relaxation and enjoyment after a hard day at work or at school. No, it is they know very well what they're doing, right? The billions of dollars they spend in the music industry.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
We cannot rely on the U.S. or its allies to champion democracy around the world, said Global Grassroots Movement Progressive International. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. and its allies are fueling worldwide erosion of democracy, analysis shows. Stay tuned for more. Recent internal attacks on democracy and human rights by the United States and many of its allies, which often portray themselves as exporters of such ideals, are driving an overall erosion of democracy worldwide, according to a new analysis. The New York Times analyzed an annual report released earlier this year by VDEM, a Swedish research institute that collects data on democracy and autocratic governments around the world, finding that the United States and several of the countries it's considered allies in recent decades have shifted substantially away from operating as democracies, with attacks on voting rights, judicial independence, and the rights of the media among the factors driving the erosion. Much of the world's backsliding is not imposed on democracies by foreign powers, but rather is a rot rising within the world's most powerful network of mostly democratic alliances. The U.S. and its allies drove increases in democracy scores, according to VDEM's reporting, throughout the 1990s, accounting for 9% of democratic growth around the world. But in the past decade, the Times analysis showed 36% of all democratic backsliding has happened in the U.S. and U.S.-aligned countries and regimes. Max Fisher at the Times wrote, "Much of the world's backsliding is not imposed on democracies by foreign powers, but rather is a rot rising within the world's most powerful network of mostly democratic alliances." VDM's report titled "Autocratization Turns Viral" pointed to the arrest of journalists for their reporting on the coronavirus pandemic and the detention of hundreds of citizens for discussing the issue on social media as examples of democratic erosion that has intensified in the last year. The group pointed to an assault on the judiciary and the press in Hungary as evidence of the deterioration of democracy dating back to as early as 2010, when the right-wing government led by Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party enacted several media laws that curtailed media freedom substantially. The Times analysis comes amid an intensifying assault on voting rights and elections by the Republican Party in the U.S., and the failure of the Democratic Party, which controls the White House and both chambers of Congress, to eliminate the legislative filibuster to allow the passage of far-reaching voting rights legislation. As Common Dreams reported earlier this month, the state-level congressional maps drawn by Republican legislatures could give the party a 13-2 advantage among representatives to the U.S. House, while the conservative takeover of the federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, has put reproductive rights in peril. VDEM's report also pointed to the spread of disinformation that the U.S. government has frequently engaged in regarding the U.S. COVID-19 pandemic, with anti-science claims from the right, including former President Donald Trump, contributing to a stark partisan divide in recent COVID-19 deaths, as Common Dreams reported recently. However, the Times emphasized the VDM's data shows the trend away from U.S. democracy accelerated during Trump's presidency but predated it. It would be too easy to say this can all be explained by Trump, Siva Ganeski, a political scientist at the University of Toronto, told the Times. VDM's findings and the outlet's analysis left critics of American exceptionalism and U.S. foreign policy, including numerous wars, which both Democrats and Republicans have claimed were aimed at spreading democracy, asking how the U.S. will continue to claim authority on democratic ideals. If the U.S. actually undermines democracy, how else shall we justify U.S. supremacy? Tweeted Dr. Anil Shelin of the Quincy Institute. As the Times noted, the erosion of democracy in the U.S. has not gone unnoticed by the global community. Very few in any public survey think American democracy is a good example for other countries to follow, a recent Pew Research Center study found. On average, only 17% of people in surveyed countries called U.S. democracy worth emulating, while 23% said it had never offered a good example. American prosperity may no longer look so appealing either because of growing problems like inequality, as well as the rise of China as an alternate economic model. An awareness of the United States' domestic problems, mass shootings, polarization, racial injustice has greatly affected perceptions. To people worldwide, tweeted David Adler, general coordinator of the global grassroots movement Progressive International, it comes as no surprise that we cannot rely on the United States of America or its allies to champion democracy around the world. Progressive International said, we need a new champion owned and operated by the popular forces of the world.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Muslims' duty towards the all-inclusiveness of Islam, promoting Islam's viewpoint.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
Well, Islamic texts explicitly reject this, and we Muslims should pay attention to this matter. When I say that we should do our duty, I primarily mean that we should promote and express the view of Islam about itself and about the areas of human life it cares about, it gives an opinion about, It works on, it explains, it promotes, and it expresses. This is the first step. Then we should try to put these into practice. What Islam states is that the field of activity of this religion is the entire scope of human life, ranging from human emotions to social, political, and international issues, and including issues related to all of humanity. This has been clearly explained in the Holy Quran. If someone denies this, they have not paid attention to the words of the Quran.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There is a verse in the Quran that says, O you who believe, celebrate the praise of Allah and do this often and glorify Him morning and evening. The Holy Quran, Surah 33, verses 41 and 42. This is an issue related to one's beliefs and emotions. But there is another verse that states, those who believe fight in the cause of Allah, and those who reject faith fight in the cause of evil. So fight against the friends of Satan. The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 76. This is another verse. So, celebrate the praise of Allah and fight against the friends of Satan mean that this entire vast scope is covered by the deen. One verse addresses the Holy Prophet saying, stand to prayer by night, but not all night. Half of it, or a little less, or a little more, and recite the Quran in slow, measured, rhythmic tones. The Holy Quran, Surah 73, verses 2 to 4.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.